Hello, Rebels. This is Attorney Augustus Corbett, a.k.a. the Minister of Justice, and with me is...
Attorney Chloe Corbett, a.k.a. the Duchess of Justice.
And we are the Defiant Lawyers. We do legal analysis of trending politics, policies, personalities, and pop culture to provide you information to defy this unjust legal system. If you're new to our channel, please subscribe and hit the notification bell. With that said, Chloe, what do we have on deck today?
We have a lot to discuss today. We're going to be talking about the legacy of all-white juries in the context of the Ahmaud Arbery trial. We're also going to be talking about the Cal Rittenhouse trial. Both occurred last week, so I'm ready to get into it.
All right, so right after this short, brief message, we will get back into this. I am so excited about it. What we're going to discuss a little bit today is the legacy of all-white juries in the context of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. First of all, let me say about this trial, Chloe, that it is very sad every time I watch the video of this young man being what many people described as lynched. Okay, it's not with the rope, it's with the shotgun. You got three people, two in front of him, one following him in a pickup, and he's kind of sandwiched in between these three people. And all he's doing is literally jogging. Now, what they are, their defense is self-defense. And as a criminal defense attorney who has represented and tried self-defense cases, I'm telling you, it is hard for me to see self-defense in this case. All this young man was doing was jogging. He was unarmed. He had nothing to cause imminent danger in this situation. And that is absolutely necessary in a self-defense trial, at least in Texas. I don't know what Georgia law says, but in Texas, the person who uses deadly force must reasonably believe that he is in threat of imminent deadly force. And with someone jogging who's unarmed, I just don't see where he was posing any imminent threat to any of these three people. Now, they got into a tussle with him, and at that point, this young man was fighting for his life. And he was fighting against, again, three people, two of which he knew were armed and were holding guns. So if you initiate contact and you're armed and then you turn around and say you were engaged in self-defense, that's kind of a strong argument to make. However, despite how it looks to me and how it looks to the public, there are 12 people, I think there are 12 people on this jury who are going to make the decision. They're going to hear all the evidence, and they're going to decide if these three people are guilty of murdering Ahmaud Arbery. Now, the problem with these 12 people is 11 of them are white, and only one of them is black. And that is causing a lot of concern, and rightfully so. How in the world did this jury end up being a nearly white jury, all white jury, or nearly white, a nearly all white jury? How could that happen? Given the legacy of all white juries in the South, we can think about the Emmett Till trial. The young man was murdered. Absolutely no question about it. Yet the two defendants were found not guilty by an all-white jury. That has happened over and over and over and over again in the South. How that happened here is a head scratcher for the public, but not for us lawyers, because we know how this works And I want to explain a little bit about how this happened, okay, this all-white jury. So I want to start with this case called Batson v. Kentucky. And that case specifically dealt with whether blacks could be excluded from the jury, because that's what was going on. Prosecutors felt like having blacks on the jury would give an advantage to a black defendant. And so they would use their peremptory and cause challenges, especially their peremptory challenges, to eliminate black jury members. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. Can't do that. You can't exclude people on the basis of race. Okay, that is racial discrimination. That is systemic racism. That is prohibited under our Constitution, under the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law, under the Due Process Clause. I mean, it's just not something that is allowed. However, in that same case, the U.S. Supreme Court said, but if the prosecutor can offer a race-neutral reason for excluding a black person, then it's likely okay. So it gives black potential jury members some rights to be on a jury, but then it sort of takes it away, okay? It kind of takes it away because the prosecutor can offer, or defense for that matter, this works both ways. The prosecutor or the defense can offer sometimes the most ridiculous reasons, so long as they're race neutral, and get around the Batson rule, get around the Batson case. And I've seen it happen many times. I mean, literally almost any reason other than a racial reason can be accepted to get around the Batson challenge. And in this case, the judge actually said from the bench that there appeared to be intentional discrimination. Yet he allowed this jury to sit, and he said it was because under Georgia law, consistent with Batson, the defense was able to offer race-neutral reasons. And so they used their 24, they had a total of 24 strikes, okay? Since there are three defendants, each one, the judge gave each one of them 8 strikes, 24 total. They used their 24 strikes to get rid of nearly, in fact, all of the jury, all of the black jurors, and they ended up with one black jury member, black jury member. So that's how that happened. They just skirted around the Batson case. They just skirted around the Batson rule by offering race neutral reasons for excluding the blacks from the jury. So basically, I am now not hopeful at all that the Arbery family will get justice here. We have a very dark and horrid legacy of what happens when the defendant is black and the jury is white or nearly white. It typically doesn't go well, and especially when in a criminal trial, all the defense need is one person to have reasonable doubt, and that's it. Now, what I don't know is whether or not Georgia requires a unanimous jury. But in states or jurisdictions where a unanimous jury is required, the defense only needs to raise reasonable doubt with one of the jurors. So again, I'm just not hopeful that the Arbery family is going to get justice here. So that's how that happened.
I agree. I'm not very hopeful at all. And I want to give a little context to our listeners about the concept of the right to have a trial in front of a jury of your peers, and how it has been a fundamental cornerstone of our criminal justice system since America was founded. Because the British settlers came over from England and Great Britain, where the king was the judge, the juror, and the executioner. So if you were accused of a crime under the British monarchy, the king would decide whether or not you lived and your guilt, and you were you had to prove that you were innocent. When the settlers came over here and the founding fathers, you know, were debating how they wanted our country to be, there was a few concepts that became the cornerstone of our legal system. And one of those was that a person accused of a crime by the government is presumed innocent. And the other is that everyone has to have has a right to have a trial in front of the jury, and that the government has the burden to prove this person's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And the jury will decide whether or not that person is guilty. And a part of that fundamental concept is that the jury should be a cross section of the county in which that person lives in. And here in Glenn County, the population of Glenn County, Georgia, it's about 66% white, according to the U.S. Census government website, and about 26% black. So about 2/3 white, one fourth white, and then other races. So there should at least be that makeup of the jury in this Ahmaud Arbery case.
Well, I'm sorry for interrupting you. Could you give those numbers again? Because I think you got a little bit confused.
Sure. And let me read it directly. So according to the U.S. Census government website, the percentage of white people in Glenn County, Georgia is 69%. The percentage of black residents in Glenn County, Georgia is 26%. Asian, 1.6%. Hispanic, 6.8%. Okay. So 70% of Glenn County's residents are white, and about 25% are black. So
that means 1/4 of the jury should be blacks, at least 1/4. So if there are 12 jury members, then they should have at least about 3 blacks on that jury, right?
Yes, that's exactly what that means. But just as you described, under the Baxson case, when an attorney uses their peremptory strikes, they can be used for any reason as long as it's not based on gender, race, and or sex. But if they give a reason, well, this person is a carpenter, so we don't want that person on our jury, even though that person is black. Or this person is wearing a red shirt, but we don't want that person on our jury. It's a black person. So as long as they give race-based neutral reasons to strike the black people off the jury, under Batson, the judge can rule that is permissible under the law. Now, just to explain the jury selection process to people who've never been in a courtroom or seen a jury trial, what happens is that 50, 60, 70, 80 people from the county will come into the courtroom. The prosecutor will have a chance to ask questions of the potential jury members. The defense side will have a chance to ask questions of the jury members. And then the attorneys will go in front of the judge and tell the judge, we want to strike juror 3, 5, 8, and 9 for this reason. Or we cause juror 10, 11, and 14 because the way they answered violates the law. So in the Ahmaud Arbery trial, the defense attorneys used their 24 peremptory strikes to strike black jurors. And according to what was reported at the pretrial hearing, one of the defense attorneys for the men who killed Ahmaud Arbery expressed concern, and I quote, white males born in the South over 40 years of age without 4-year college degrees, sometimes euphemistically known as Bubba or Joe Sixpack, seem to be significantly underrepresented in the jury pool, end quote. So that tells you they were specifically looking for white men from the South over 40 without college degrees, known as Bubba, to sit on their jury. And they got it. And it's allowed under the law. And this type of selection for when black people are involved in the criminal justice system has happened for hundreds of years since we've been in this country.
Well, if one of the defense attorneys went on the record as saying that he wants a jury that consists of white Bubbas, then he's clearly saying that he's striking juries, or he's at least inferring strongly that he's striking potential jury members on the basis of race. And maybe that's why the judge said, well, there seemed to be intentional discrimination, yet he set that jury. I think there's potentially an appellate issue there. Okay. There's potentially an appellate issue. I don't know, again, Georgia's law regarding appeals and so forth, but potentially there is that appellate issue, and maybe that's also why the judge put that on the record, so that could potentially be something that prosecutors could use to appeal this case. All right, so thank you for that context. Again, that's why this all happened. There are a couple other issues. That's why this jury has only one black on it. Race is all a part of this. This is the state of Georgia. This is the South. This is the former Confederate state. So race is all in here. There's no way around it. Three white men shooting a young black, unarmed young black man who was not breaking any law. Of course, they tried to say he had been in some houses, some vacant houses, and they thought he was a thief and robber and all of that. Of course, they always assassinate the character of a black person that they kill. But at the moment on that video, and that video is the primary witness here, okay? That video, which we've all seen multiple times, that is the biggest witness in this case. And so what those jury members must do is either believe their lying eyes, so to speak, okay, or do the right thing. In other words, all they got to do is look at the video and see that Ahmad was not posing any imminent threat to those three men. Again, you cannot start a fight, you're armed and the other person's not armed, and then argue that I implored self-defense when you instigated the contact, the confrontation or the fight. You were the only one armed, okay? I mean, that's just not a case for self-defense. Anyway, there are a couple other things about this trial that we want to talk about briefly, and then we're going to get to the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. So, all right, what's the other? The other issue is, the prosecution want to admit into evidence a photo of young Albury lying on the ground, you know, basically wheezing for life at the point of death, showing the shotgun wound to his, you know, abdomen, chest. A gruesome picture, a gruesome, gruesome, gruesome picture. And the defense is fighting that. The defense is like, no, we don't want that seen. Why? Because they are arguing that, or argued that, it would prejudice the jury. It would take the jury's focus off the main evidence, and they would just get inflamed. They would get upset. They would be angry. They would be, you know, just really sort of teed off at the defendants just based on that photo, okay? And they're saying that photo, which shows young Albury dying, was the result of self-defense. However, that photo may take the jurors' minds off their self-defense case, and it will prejudice them. And not only was there a photo of Albury in that condition, but there was also a photo on one of those trucks that showed a Confederate flag. And so they're making the same argument about both of those photos causing prejudice with the jury. That's something that we as attorneys are very familiar with. It is a I was about to say a Texas rules of evidence, but it's pretty much in all jurisdictions. In Texas, it's a 403. That's the section of the Texas evidence law that we find it in. The rule is 403. And again, it does say that the judge can keep evidence out if the probative value of the evidence is substantially outweighed by the risk of prejudicing the jury. So the judge has to make that, as the gatekeeper, the judge has to make that determination about that photo, as well as the photo showing the Confederate flag. Now, we're going to wait until the end of this video. Chloe and I are going to debate whether or not the judge ought to keep that out. And she's going to take the position of the prosecutor, because she was once a prosecutor. She is a former prosecutor. And just for the sake of argument, it may not be what she believes should happen, you know, but she's, just to make this interesting, is going to argue the side of the prosecution. And I will argue the side of defense, because I've never been a prosecutor. And I don't know what that's all about. I don't have anything against prosecutors. And in fact, I think we need more fair-minded, justice-minded African-American prosecutors in prosecutors' offices around the country. But anyway, that is what that whole debate is about. You know, the defense, and I would have done the same thing if I was a defense lawyer. I would have not wanted that photo in the trial, admitted into evidence. I would not have wanted either one of those photos. We would have made the same 403 arguments that they made, no question about it. So we'll wait and debate that at the end of this video. Okay, so that. You know, you may want to you may have some comments about the photos, or you can save them for our debate afterwards. Otherwise, we can move on to the Kyle Rittenhouse case.
Yeah, I'll save my comments about the photos in the verdict section, where we're going to be arguing about whether or not the judge should admit those two photos into evidence. I will be putting my prosecutorial hat back on, just like you said. I was a prosecutor for a couple years before I joined with you, and I enjoyed my time as a prosecutor. I knew that I didn't want to do it long term, but it really was it was great. I enjoyed it, and I learned a lot. And now I can use those skills to help people and help defend people. But just to briefly talk about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial before we do our verdict section, just to give a little update for people who have not been following it closely, Kyle Rittenhouse is a young white person who was 17 at the time when he was arrested, and he was charged with felony homicide relating to the shooting and killing of Anthony M. Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum. And then he was also accused of felony attempted homicide for allegedly wounding Gage Grosskreutz. And the context of this is that last year, Jacob Blake, was a black man who was shot and killed by the police in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And just like with the George Floyd protest, with the Ahmaud Arbery protest, people began to protest to just try to seek justice for Joseph Blake. And there were protests happening around that area in Wisconsin and around the country. However, Kyle Rittenhouse was from Illinois, and he came to the protest in Wisconsin armed. And he presented himself as a medic, according to people who have been interviewed at the scene, when he killed those two men. But he was armed with a handgun, and instead of, one, he was not a medic, obviously, and instead of peacefully protesting, he shot and killed two people and allegedly wounded.
I think it was just one person who passed, Chloe.
I thought it was two, but I could be wrong.
I'm looking at it, too. Rittenhouse fired an AR-15 style weapon 8 times, 4 shots at Joseph Rosenbaum, who was unarmed, 2 shots at unarmed, unknown individual who kicked Rittenhouse, 1 fatal shot at Anthony Huber, and 1 shot at Gage Grosskreutz or something. So I really do believe it was just one person who passed.
Okay. Well, that's a blessing that only one person passed, and we pray for the family of the man who passed.
Amen.
So he's on trial for the killing of that person, and there's a couple issues that have been related to his trial. The first is that the judge over the case, presiding over the case, ordered that the man who was killed could not be addressed as a victim. So when the prosecutor is discussing what happened, discussing this man who was killed, he could not, the judge ordered that he cannot be referred to as a victim.
And apparently I don't think the two surviving victims could, I don't think he wanted them referred to as victims as well, right?
I believe so.
Okay.
So I guess anyone who was affected by this, who were involved in this case, who were shot at, one killed, the other two allegedly wounded, they cannot be referred to as victims. In fact, the judge said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the evidence will show what they were doing, and if they were rioting and looting, then the defense can refer to them as such.
Wow.
This is the role of the victim with the prosecutor and with the district attorney's office cannot be, it's almost hard to articulate, because the district attorney's offices and prosecutor's offices in our country, they see themselves and under the Constitution, they are there for the protection of the public. So they are there to prosecute crimes that have happened against people. And they align themselves with the people who have suffered from those crimes. And we refer to them as victims. So the victim will typically either report their case to the police, who would then transfer the file over to the prosecutor's office, or sometimes victims can go directly to the prosecutor's office and report crimes there as well and try to get someone prosecuted for those harms. So prosecutors place a lot of value on their victims. There is a relationship that is developed between the prosecutor and the victim. The prosecutor sees themselves as being the voice for someone who may be vulnerable. Now, even though there's not an attorney-client privilege like what we have as defense attorneys with our clients, there are specific duties that prosecutors have to their victims. And oftentimes, they would not do something on a case without speaking to the victim first, asking what the victim wants done on the case, or et cetera. So there's been a lot of times where we have, you know, moved for a case to be dismissed or for some type of plea deal, and the prosecutor would not do it because they would consult with their victim and get their impact. So what the victim says about their case has a lot of impact on prosecutors. And when I was one, I developed, you know, a close relationship with my victims. I put myself in their shoes so that I could properly present this case at trial. So the fact that this judge has said that the prosecutor cannot refer to these men as victims kind of goes against, you know, what our legal system has come to when it comes to the relationship of people who have been harmed or hurt by crimes and the prosecutor's office.
Well, I can't wait till the verdict comes up where we debate that issue as well, because I see that totally different. And I'll save my comments for then. I sure will. I'll save my comments for then, because, you know, as a criminal defense lawyer, both of us are now, I see it. In fact, I had that conversation with a prosecutor maybe a month ago on a case. You know, she kept referring to the alleged victim, as the victim, and our client was really the victim. So I just had to point out to her, this person is not the victim. The person you're saying, that's not the victim. We represent the victim, okay? So we'll talk about it, though, during the verdict.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. Another issue in this trial has been the judge excused a juror for making a racist joke. The juror was, when he was being escorted out of the courtroom, apparently or allegedly, he made a racist joke about a former, I think it was about maybe Ahmaud Arbery. And
Jacob Blake.
Jacob Blake. Okay, excuse me. He made a racist joke about Jacob Blake. Somehow it got back to the judge. And after hearing, the judge decided that this juror should be excused. The defense nor the prosecutor, obviously, there were no objections to this juror being excused. But it kind of just shows to you, if this juror is bold enough to make that joke to a deputy, kind of what are in the hearts of the remaining jurors who are listening to the evidence and will be deciding whether or not Cal Rittenhouse is guilty of killing the, or injuring others. So even though, you know, our system runs on the jury system, and we as attorneys do our best to get the proper jurors on the panel who are not biased and will listen to the evidence, listen to the testimony, we don't know what they are feeling on the inside as well. And as we tell a lot of our clients, taking a case and presenting a case to a jury is risky.
That's right.
Because what happens in this case is now taken out of your hands and it's put into the hands of 6 or 12 people who have a vast variety of experiences in this country and beliefs.
And sometimes, despite our best efforts, we're not able to eliminate those people who are trying to stay quiet, trying not to be seen or heard, who, in other words, they want to get on the jury to sort of sabotage it because they got these feelings or this thinking or these biases. And so they want to be on the jury to make a statement, you know. And we do our level best as attorneys to identify those people, to get them to talking, to get them expressing themselves so that we know who we need to get off the jury. But sometimes our best efforts still will result in those kinds of folks on a jury.
Yes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
So the first week of trial just ended in the Cal Rittenhouse case. So we were going to be keeping abreast of any major issues that come up. We may do a recap video once both trials are completed and we get verdicts on the case. So just to recap on the Cal Rittenhouse trial, the two big things that we discussed today is that the judge did not allow the prosecutors to refer to the man who was killed and the man who were injured as victims. So they could be potentially addressed as rioters or looters by the defense. And second, there was a juror who was released from the jury because of a racist joke that he made. So we're going to be keeping you all abreast of all of this as these new developments happen.
Yes. And one final thing about the Ahmaud Arbery trial, it actually had its first week this week. It took several weeks to pick a jury. A lot of folks didn't want to serve on this jury, and there was a whole lot of mess, as I described earlier. But they were able to give opening statements on Friday, and they also, I think, had one witness. The prosecutor called one witness, a deputy sheriff. I think he was the first person on the scene who saw young Arbery lying there dying or having deceased. So we're at the very early stages of this trial. And like Chloe said, we will, as necessary, do updates. All right. All right. So here's my favorite part. We get chance to debate these issues. One, whether or not the judge in the Arbery trial should keep those photos out, should find that they're inadmissible because of their likelihood of prejudicing the jury. So we're going to debate that, and we're going to debate whether or not the judge in the Rittenhouse case should have allowed the prosecutor to refer to those shooting victims as victims. I don't think he should. Chloe thinks, and she's taken, think you should. And I mean, she's taken again. We're both now criminal defense attorneys, but for the sake of argument, she's going to argue the side of the prosecution.
Yes.
Right? Did I describe that right?
You did.
Okay. All right. So we're going to do that. Hold on just a second. All right. So should the judge keep out those photos in the Ahmaud Arbery trial? I would say, okay, I do have to qualify this. All right, I'm speaking as a criminal defense attorney. I am not saying this is what I actually think should happen because I think these men ought to be found guilty, all right? But again, we're going to make it interesting, so I'm going to argue as if I was representing one of these men or if this was one of our clients and the argument that I would make. All right. But again, I think they should be found guilty. I think the judge should absolutely allow these pictures in the photo on a personal level into evidence. He should allow these photos to be admitted into evidence. But I'm going to argue the very opposite. All right. Good lawyer can do both, can go both ways. Right.
Yes.
All right. So, Your Honor, we believe that these photos will substantially, the prejudicial effect of these photos will substantially outweigh the probative value of admitting these photos. What the court is going to be able to get from these photos is going to be overshadowed by the emotional response that the jury members are going to have seeing these photos. It's going to take their attention away from the fact that this was a self-defense situation. We, and when I say we, I'm talking about the defense team and especially our clients, are heartbroken to see this young man lying there dying or having died. This is not the outcome that we wanted, but our clients were placed in a live or die situation. And they did what they had to do to live. And so as sad as those pictures are, heart-wrenching as they are to Mr. Arbery's family, they should not be admitted into evidence because, once again, they will prejudice this jury.
Your Honor, let's go back to the basic facts of this case. There was a mid-20s young man who was out jogging and who was shot and killed by those three men who are on trial now. And we believe that the jury needs to see the extent of what those people, of what those men did to Ahmaud Arbery. The picture of his body after they shot him is absolutely relevant to this trial. And as Your Honor knows, all relevant evidence is admissible. Now, with them claiming self-defense, they're not denying that they shot and killed Mr. Arbery. That's already been established. So we would ask for Your Honor to allow the jury to see the full picture of what happened once those men shot and killed Mr. Arbery. One, because it's relevant and relevant evidence is admissible. And two, because the jury would not be unfairly prejudiced by seeing that picture. It will in fact give the jury a better understanding of what happened and the consequences of what happened. So we strongly disagree with defense counsel that the probative value will be substantially outweighed by any prejudicial effect on the jury. One, because it's relevant, and two, because that picture is actually probative in order to give the jury a full picture. So we will ask that the court will allow us to enter this picture into evidence.
Well, Judge, in conclusion, I would simply say that whether it is or not relevant is not relevant here. What's relevant here is whether or not this picture will prejudice the jury, and whether that potential prejudicial effect will just overshadow the jury's ability to look objectively at the facts is what we're most concerned about. So we won't argue with counsel as to whether or not it's relevant. We're just saying the probative value of what she believes is relevant evidence is substantially outweighed by looking at this photo and the photo of the Confederate flag. It takes their attention away from the facts. All right, so that's our argument. Counsel, do you have a final argument on this, or can we move to the Rittenhouse?
One final point I'd like to make in terms of the truck with the Confederate flag. We believe the jury needs to see that because it would go into the motive and into the intent of what was going on in the defendant's mind. So again, Judge, we will ask that you will allow us to admit into evidence the gruesome, sad picture of Mr. Arbery's body after he was shot and killed by the defendants, and the picture of the Confederate flag on the defendant's truck. Thank you.
Well, I know we need to move on, but it's rather offensive, quite frankly, that counsel is implying that our clients are racist or that they had a racial motive for using deadly force. That is offensive. There's been nothing admitted into evidence that goes to that issue. And this is not a hate crime. This is not a crime involving denying someone civil rights, their civil rights based on race. This is a self-defense murder trial. And so we resent counsel even suggesting that the Confederate flag photo, which is really just a part of the old Georgia flag, is indicative of whether these men are racist. All right, now, Chloe, all right, so now, Rittenhouse. All right. All right, so Judge, we are asking that you will prohibit the prosecution from referring to these three men as victims. These three men really were lawbreakers. They were rioting, they were looting, or they were helping others riot and loot. And unfortunately, they got shot because they put themselves in that situation. Our client came to this protest to provide support and protection and security for the law-abiding citizens of this city. And that's what he did. And we see from the video, Judge, that he did not shoot them until they had placed him in danger of his life. So why the state now thinks it can come back and refer to these people as victims just really astounds us. They were not victims. They were looters and rioters.
Well, Judge, the state's response would be counsel was referring to alleged acts that have not been entered into evidence. There's been no evidence that the man who was killed and the other two men who were injured were engaging in any law-breaking activities.
We saw the videos, Judge. We saw videos of them out there acting like looters, rioters, hooligans, thugs. You pick your words.
Judge, what we saw in the videos were those men exercising their constitutional right to peacefully protest in this country. As this court is well aware, us as American citizens, we have the right to peacefully protest. And that's what these men were doing. And according to Merriam-Webster Dictionary and Black's Law Dictionary, a victim is a person who has been attacked, injured, robbed, or killed by someone else. Those three men are victims, Judge. One man is dead. The other two men were injured. And it has been the cornerstone of our justice system that when a person has been killed or hurt by someone else, we refer to that person as victim. We don't believe saying victim would have any prejudicial effect on the jury. We believe we are saying facts. And by allowing us to refer to those men as victims, it's going against precedent that has been done since this our legal system came into fruition. So we would ask the court to allow the state to refer to our victims as victims, which they are, so that we can focus on meeting our burden, which we will, of proving the guilt of Mr. Rittenhouse beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you.
All right, there you have it. So we know what happened. The judge ruled in favor of the defense that these prosecutors could not refer to these three gentlemen, one deceased, as victims. As a defense attorney, I agree with that. But as, an African-American male who knew that this whole thing arose because of the shooting of Jacob Blake by a young man, a young vigilante who showed up with an AR-15 and shot these people, I feel a completely different way, from that perspective. So, McClure, you did a great job arguing that and arguing the Albury issues. I enjoy that particular section of the show. Yes. You're a formidable opponent, but, I
learn from the best.
All right. Thank you. So I guess you're referring to me. I mean,
yes, of course.
I just assumed you were, but I don't know.
Yes.
You were mentored by some great lawyers in the prosecutor's office, and shout out to them. But that's our show for today, you all. It has been quite a week in these trials with Ahmaud Arbery and Kyle Rittenhouse. We are going to stay abreast of what's going on. We're going to update you as necessary. We're not going to be coming back just to say, this or that happened. If it's significant, if it's important, we'll come back, because we're using these things. Remember our introduction. We do legal analysis of trending politics, policies, personalities, and pop culture. So we use these things to teach you the law. So you learned today about jury members and the Batson rule, picking juries pursuant to the Batson rule. You learned about Texas rules of evidence, but you learned about an evidence rule 403, and Chloe mentioned 402 relevance. And we learned about rules of evidence 101, I believe it is, where the judge is the gatekeeper. He's the one who decides what basically happens in the trial. And in the Rittenhouse trial, he said no to calling those three men victims. So we're teaching you the law. So pay close attention. We're teaching you the law so you can defy this unjust legal system. Chloe, any closing words?
No, this has been a great discussion. Just like you said, any important developments, we will come back and make a video. We want you rebels to comment down below. Let us know what you want to hear from us, what you want us to analyze and talk about.
That's right.
What is trending for you, what you're interested in. We will take all options into consideration. Please share this video with your family and friends so that they too can learn and be able to defy this unjust legal system as well. With that, we can't wait to see you in the next video.
Yeah, and by the way, you all, in your comments, tell us who won the debate, okay?
Yes,
let us know if it was Chloe or whether it was me. We want to hear from you. All right? All right, we're out of here.
All right.